This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Today we'll have a quick shifty at the economics of class actions, and I'm going to say some bad words now. Christmas shopping. It's for your own good. We'll get to it. Something kind of weird happened this week in, of all places, the budget of our largest state. The New South Wales Treasurer, Dominic Perrottet, is proposing to replace stamp duty with a land tax. Not yet, and not all at once. It would be a gradual process. But still, economists love land taxes, love them. From their point of view, this looks delicious. Miranda Stewart is not an economist, but she is the director of the tax group at the University of Melbourne. So I asked her, why would this be good policy?
The base, of course, is land. Land is immobile, can't leave the jurisdiction. If it's properly registered and identified and valued, so you do need good valuation processes and a good register of the land that's available, then it is a very good and stable base for raising revenue. From an efficiency perspective, a land tax should fall on the landowner, and it should not affect market transactions, other forms of transactions or decisions that people make in the economy. So that's why it's seen from an economic perspective to be a good tax. From a revenue perspective, you've got a land tax, you know, you've got the base there, you've got the land in the jurisdiction. So if it's well designed, it should also be a good tax from that perspective. And from a fairness perspective, people who own land generally are wealthier, more comfortably off than people who don't. And so we have a kind of inherent progressivity, in a sense, across the population.
What this land tax will do is replace stamp duty. So I suppose another way of coming at this question is, what is the problem with stamp duty?
Yeah, so the states, New South Wales and other states, levy a stamp duty, which is a transaction tax. There used to be stamp duty, so they're on all sorts of conveyances and on bank documents and shares, and there are still stamp duties on sales of businesses in some circumstances. So, you know, whenever there's some sort of registered sale or transaction, hence you have this historical, very old tax called a stamp duty tax. And in fact, it used to be a physical stamp on the document. Ah. So you can see that's why it was called a stamp tax. You had to get your document stamped to show you'd paid the tax. So the issues with stamp duty are that because it's a tax on transactions, it's an immediate cost or additional disincentive for entering into transactions. So it operates as a friction or an impediment in the economy as a whole. And if we just bring it back to sales of land, it pushes up the cost of that transaction, creates a disincentive to do that transaction as a result, because of that marginal cost. And that undermines mobility in the economy and other smooth economic transactions.
Now, earlier, one of the things you mentioned was fairness. Now, I can see how a land tax delivers a steady income stream for a government, but is it fairer for the home buyer?
So, fairer than stamp duty. I guess there's different kinds of fairness. So I already suggested that a land tax is fairer in the sense that those who are in the process of owning land, who have access to that asset, are better off than those who don't. So it is appropriate that we tax those who do have land. We already do it, of course, at the local council level with rates paid to local councils. Rates are basically a form of land tax, right? They're on the value of the land, but they're fairly low in Australia, and they're also capped by the state governments in some circumstances, and they go directly to finance those local services. So the proposal here would be to increase that, and of course for that revenue to go to the state government. Are they fairer? Well, I guess there is this question of access. So in order to get into the housing market, of course people have to borrow to finance the purchase. They need that deposit. They will also have to borrow to finance the stamp duty. So it pushes up, if you like, the entry cost. And there's definitely an argument that that's not fair. And then stamp duty, because prices have been increasing substantially over the last 2-3 decades, people who bought into properties a long time ago paid relatively low stamp duty. But those people are now sitting on extremely valuable assets. And it's generally the case that we probably are not taxing our capital and assets sufficiently in Australia, those who hold wealth compared to those who don't.
Is it going to affect owner-occupiers differently to property investors?
I guess it will tax owner-occupiers even though they're not generating a market income from their property. So, of course, that's one of the things about a land tax. It's an annual impost and there has to be cash to pay it. Rental property investors, some of them will already be paying a land tax, at least in Victoria they might be. One interesting thing to think about with rental property investors is that they deduct their various costs and expenses for federal income tax purposes.
Uh-huh.
And so they can deduct land tax and rates against their federal income tax. So there's a little bit of a state-federal shift, actually, of the burden. I haven't seen anyone mention that as a consequence.
No.
So it's an annual cost. It will be an annual cost for homeowners that is not deductible, but it will be an annual cost for rental investors that is deductible.
This is our biggest state talking about moving ahead with this reform. Does that change the kind of landscape for other jurisdictions?
Yeah, I think it certainly does. It is really interesting that New South Wales is seriously talking about this. These ideas about reform shifting from stamp duty to land tax have been around for a long time. As you know, the Australian Capital Territory has initiated that reform. They're about 8 years into a long transition from stamp duty to land tax. So it is a big deal. It potentially does make it more interesting for the other states. Transition is one of the biggest challenges with this kind of reform. And so it's quite interesting to see what the Treasurer has proposed, this idea of making it optional, that you sort of opt in to the land tax approach. I think probably people would be not quite sure how that's going to work, but they've estimated that it would take some decades before about half the land in the state would be kind of in the system if they did it this way.
Interesting, though, you only get to opt in once, don't you? Once you've opted in, that affects every other owner in the future of that property.
Of that property, but presumably you as an individual could opt in on a different property.
Yes.
Or not. Transition is one of the biggest challenges. And so the way the ACT is doing it is a very long 20-year transition, which I suspect is feeling a little painful for those who live in the ACT. The other thing he's proposed is to keep stamp duty at the top. And that's an interesting question. It could be that there is still a good argument that at the top of the market, there should still be some tax on the purchase.
Because at the top of the market, people can afford that.
Yeah, so you're in an area where people either have the money to buy the tax or they can afford to borrow. So access is not an issue at the top of the market, and equity really is an issue. And that price point of, you know, when you buy and sell, that's quite a good time to collect tax, of course, because people have the money and you can access it as the government. A combination of having a tax at the top on transactions and land tax sort of system for most people in the market, that's probably quite a good combination, actually.
Professor Miranda Stewart from the University of Melbourne Law School. This is The Money with me, Richard Addy.
The Prime Minister is defending his government's handling of the robo-debt scandal after the Commonwealth agreed to settle a class action out of court. The settlement is worth $1.2 billion and includes $721 million in debts the government had already agreed to repay.
I'm sure you heard about this. It's a big deal. The government settled this case just before it had to appear in court. It was a massive class action. And it reminded me that they are quite the thing now. So what are we talking about here? What are the sums? Are we seeing more of them? Michael Legg's a law professor at the University of New South Wales.
I don't think there's any argument that we are on a sort of an upward curve. So there are more class actions being brought. You know, the types of class actions, I think, is sort of starting to, like, the mix is varying. But the argument that is often put out by, I guess, the sort of the plaintiff's lawyers and the litigation funders is, yes, there might be more class actions being brought, but the actual number of class actions compared to litigation as a whole, compared to other sorts of things like number of listed companies or, you know, the number of, you know, like on a per capita basis, is not out of control. So you're seeing more class actions, but there shouldn't be some sort of knee-jerk reaction that, oh, everything is out of control and we need to stop this. And that in some ways is the debate.
Peter Cashman is a barrister and he's worked on class actions, but he also has an adjunct position at the University of New South Wales. And with a colleague, he's had a look at the numbers.
There's been a continuing increase in the number of class actions filed each year, particularly in recent years. So over the last 3 years, 2017 to 2019, approximately one new class action was commenced each week. That also includes a number of competing and overlapping class actions, but it also includes an increasing number of investor or shareholder class actions and also an increasing number which are financed by commercial litigation funders.
They're third parties who will fund both the lawyers' fees and they will also, I guess, take on the risk of having to pay the opponent if the class action's unsuccessful.
So they're what, specialist outfits that this is what they do?
Pretty much, yes.
Are these Australian businesses that we've heard of or where will we find them?
Look, at the moment, the estimate is that there's about 25 litigation funders active in Australia. But they use different business models and they're from different locations. If a person was going to know a litigation funder, the one that they're most likely to know would be the one that's listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, which is Omni Bridgeway, formerly IMF Bentham, which was in some ways the original litigation funder. But now we also have a number of large global funders. So these are entities out of predominantly the United States and the United Kingdom, and they're entities such as Harbour, Augusta, Vannon, and so they're based offshore, but they'll have an Australian presence. Then there's another group of funders which are, understanding how they operate is a little more difficult because they tend to be based offshore, and they're sort of corporate entities that tend to be funded by sort of high-wealth individuals or hedge funds, and they'll invest in a particular piece of litigation sort of around the world. And then probably the final category are smaller Australian companies. There's been a few that have been operating for a while, often in the area of insolvency. They have also started to enter the litigation funding market for class actions.
I don't imagine that any of these entities, and they're very different, as you've been explaining, are doing this out of the goodness of their heart. So that gets me to really the important question. Who gets the money? How's it divided if you win?
The way that it works is the litigation that gets brought as a class action has got to be litigation about seeking compensation. There's got to be a pot of money at the end. And then what will happen is out of that pot of money, there will be money that goes to pay the lawyers. And so they're usually doing the work, either no win, no fee, or the funder is paying them as they go. But they charge basically on the billable hour, so an hourly rate. Also coming out of the fund is the money that goes to the litigation funder, and that's typically a percentage. And it can vary, but it's between, I guess, like 25 and 40%. And then there'll also be some disbursements. So that's like paying, say, like an expert witness that's needed for the litigation. And then the money that's left, that's what goes to the group members or the people who have, if you like, have the cause of action, have suffered the loss.
Again, Peter Cashman has some real numbers.
Of the 90 class actions that we reviewed where we had information available, the costs incurred on the plaintiff's side were, in about 30% of those cases, over $10 million per case. That's only on the plaintiff's side. Over the 20-year period, which we looked at from 2001 to 2020, the legal costs incurred on the plaintiff's side were in excess of 15% of the total amount of the settlement obtained in those cases. The funding commissions, which were payable to the commercial funders who financed the litigation, were about 27% of the total amount recovered. And therefore, the total costs to the or the total transaction costs incurred on the plaintiff's side exceeded 40% of the total amount recovered, which is quite high and, in my view, excessive.
In some circumstances, it can be even more excessive.
Generally, where the, I guess, the problem has arisen is in relation to what we might consider smaller class actions. Now, when I say small, I'm actually meaning a class action that where the recovery is sort of lower than $30 or $40 million.
Oh, that's small, right.
Yes. So it's not like we're talking, you know, a small amount of money, but the cost of the lawyers and the cost of the litigation funding is expensive. And so when the pot of money at the end is only $30 or $40 million, then you can see half of that go in what I call transaction costs. And so as a result, the group members may in fact get less than what goes in costs.
The transaction costs are the real problem here, that and the delays which contribute to the costs. The final sums can be truly staggering.
In the most recent case which I was involved in, which settled earlier this year, which was the series of class actions against Volkswagen arising out of the diesel emission scandal, one of the plaintiff's firms involved in the conduct of that litigation, their costs exceeded $50 million over the period of the litigation, which was only over 4 years. The total costs of all parties involved in litigating that case alone exceeded over $100 million. And that doesn't include the ongoing costs that are now being incurred in administering the settlement, which makes provision for payment to about 40,000 people who own those cars. So although that's, you know, at the top end of the range, there have been other cases such as the bushfire litigation in Victoria, where the legal costs in that litigation exceeded $100 million. So these are very, very substantial numbers.
So why? What's causing that? Well, Peter Cashman's identified 15 contributing factors. I've asked for the top five.
Well, I guess inherently these cases are complex, both legally and factually, and that is a complicating factor. But by and large, there's a pretty routine denial of liability and aggressive defence of these claims. Even the most meritorious claims, such as the Volkswagen litigation, was vigorously defended, as are most others. So that obviously increases delay and maximises transaction costs. There are also a series of economic incentives to increase the amount of billable time which is incurred in both prosecuting and defending these claims on both sides, given the commercial interests of the participants in that process, both lawyers and funders. There are also, as I've indicated, high commercial returns sought by funders, which substantially increase the transaction costs at the end of the day. There are also endless procedural disputations and delays, which become very protracted, very expensive, and add to costs. And unfortunately, and this is not a unique problem with class actions, our adversarial system has not adopted or developed very effective means of getting to truth early on in civil litigation generally and class actions in particular.
He's been thinking about this for a long time, and he has some ideas about what to do.
Well, the first thing I think we need to do is to revisit the recommendations of various law reform commissions in Australia, both at state and federal level, over the past 40 years, who have recommended the establishment of a publicly funded statutory fund to finance these cases and to protect people from adverse costs. That would substantially reduce the transaction costs, in my view, and it would also provide funding in cases that don't presently get funded, which are essentially high-value, low-risk cases which commercial funders finance. Secondly, I think we ought to be able to allow lawyers generally to act on a percentage basis, as is the case in Canada, the United States, and now in the United Kingdom. Victoria is the only jurisdiction at the moment where lawyers are only recently being permitted to act on a percentage basis. That would increase competition, avoid the need for a funder in many cases, drive down costs, and in my view, makes sense, and ensures that the costs are more proportionate. Everyone talks about proportionality, but the only method of guaranteeing proportionality is the only method that's been specifically outlawed. I'd also suggest that there should be more specific statutory powers for courts to control both legal costs and funding commissions. There's endless appellate warfare at the moment about the extent to which various courts have power to make common fund orders, either during or at the conclusion of the case, and that needs to be resolved. And finally, and perhaps more problematically, I think there's a need for a cultural change about how these cases are resolved. They've become far too expensive, far too protracted, and the adversarial system is not generating cost-efficient, effective and cheap results.
Peter Cashman. You also heard from Professor Michael Legg from the University of New South Wales. This is The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. I'm just going to... Okay. Everyone ready? It's 5 weeks. It really is. And normally I wouldn't be mentioning at this stage, but it occurred to me that often certain young people I'm related to are interested in things that have to be ordered online. And I wondered when I should start. Flavio Macau is exactly the right person to ask. He's at Edith Cowan University and he's an expert on supply chains.
Well, if you're buying from overseas and clicking on free delivery, I would say that you have no time at all. You should do it this week, because the estimated delivery time from China to Australia is about 25 days. And, you know, one in every four parcels take 1 or 2 months to arrive. So you should be quick on ordering, especially if it is online, especially from overseas.
I'm old school. What if I physically go to the shops to get presents?
Well, if you go to the shops, you would rather do it sooner than later as well. Because what happens is that supply chains that usually keep those shops stocked during December, they are a little bit behind this year. As an example, if you're looking for a bicycle, it may take a lot of time to find the one that you like, and you may not find it at all. If you're looking for video games, it is really hard to find a Nintendo Switch and almost impossible to get a PS5. So even if you go physically to the shop, you may not find it at the first time, at the first place, at the price you want it, the way you want it.
Okay, so if I'm going to get something online from overseas, I've got to get doing it now. And if I want to go to the shops, I should be going out now as well. Okay, why is that, Flavio? What is going on?
Well, what is going on is that, as we all know, we have COVID, and COVID is not gone by no means. So suppliers are having a hard time to find raw materials, to find parts, to complete their production. And then it is hard to send their production, transport them here to Australia, because we have all these lockdowns happening every now and then. And we have a very problematic situation at this time on supply chains. They are under a lot of pressure, I would say.
Right. Because online purchasing, of course, has been driving this. Do we know how much it's increased?
Oh, yeah. So online shopping, it has been increasing year after year. And then we have a boom in 2020. We have an increase of over 75% in Australia in online shopping. And not Australia only. In the US, the increase is over 30%. In the UK, over 17 million people are switching to online permanently. And sales online are increasing. At Nike, as an example, worldwide, they reached their 2024 goals about 3 months ago. So they are kind of 3 years ahead of schedule on their online shopping, their goals. So that's the biggest reason why things have increased, is that, you know, people are moving to online.
Online traditionally has peaked, certainly in Australia, at Christmas. How are we going kind of month to month compared to last year's Christmas peak?
Christmas, you can sell online about 8.8 times higher than the average month. So if you usually sell 10, say in April, Christmas, you usually sell 88 of the same product. So there's a lot going on usually during Christmas. And what's happening this year is that September, which would be a month like, a regular month, was 7% higher than Christmas 2019. So a common month in 2020 was higher than the peak month in 2019. So that's why we should be, look and plan ahead about our online shopping, because this can be a very, very busy season this year.
All right. So where are the bottlenecks, Flavio, in all this?
Well, we have two main bottlenecks. One bottleneck will be on manufacturing. 7 out of 10 retailers are finding some difficulty ordering products because they are not, their inventories are really, really low. So that will be one bottleneck. And things that happened 3, 4, 5 months ago, they are hitting us now because it takes time. It takes a few months for those supply chains to come to us, the final product. And the other thing is transportation, especially last mile delivery. And if you think about transportation, you have busy times in trains and ships and everything. And we don't have the support this year of air shipments because half of their shipments, they are done in commercial flights. And we have seen a huge fall of commercial flights, especially coming to Australia, over 80%. So we cannot rely on them for delivery this Christmas. And also, if you think about last mile delivery, those people like the posties that go from door to door, we have a shortage there as well. We have places like Australia Post hiring over 4,000 people for peak time, and UPS and FedEx and others all hiring more people. But the thing is, this will not be enough. There are too many parcels, too many packages, and too many people buying online. And so this will be a bottleneck as well.
So what has happened is we've had this growth trend over years of adopting online shopping, getting more delivered. And then COVID has pushed us so far up the curve that the infrastructure, the logistics, the stuff in the background and the people just haven't had enough time to catch up yet.
Precisely. And businesses are doing their best to catch up. But it's not easy because in some places, businesses are not able to, you know, go full throttle because there are restrictions, there are lockdowns. And as we have a globalized economy, if something is happening in Indonesia or something is happening in Malaysia or something is happening in the UK, at the end of the day, it does affect what happens here in Australia. So in a global scale, we are not ready for this huge increase that we have at COVID. We have this decrease in supply because of the pandemics, and we have this huge increase in demand because people as well, they are not traveling as they used to, they have all these restrictions. So both sides of the equation are unbalanced at the moment, and this brings a risk for the deliveries this Christmas. Mm.
What about you, Flavia? I mean, you're an absolute expert in this field, but are you organized? Have you got Christmas sorted?
Oh, yes. Not only I am organized, also I got to get my kids organized because I have 2 teenage daughters at home. And this weekend, last weekend, they were writing down their Christmas list, what they want to buy. And I asked them to put the item and put the link to the item and the price. And then during this week, we will filter that because if I buy everything they want, I'll definitely go bankrupt. And then we'll find the critical items, and then we are ordering them in the coming days. So, yes, as ready as we can be.
Flavio Macau from Edith Cowan University. And that's it for the show this week. The Money is produced by Belinda Sommer. Our sound engineer is Wayne Ewan. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.